Well, I'm Georg Burgstaller. I was involved in the Schenker Documents Online project while I did my PhD. I am now no longer formally involved, but I still contribute.
I'm William Drabkin. I'm a retired professor of music at the University of Southampton. I edit the journal Music Analysis, and I continue to work as a translator for Schenker Documents Online.
And I'm Ian Bend. I'm a retired professor from Columbia University in New York. And along with Bill, I'm co-editor of the Schenker Documents Online project.
So you're all here because there's going to be a panel discussion later on today about the Schenker Documents Online project, which has been running, if I'm not mistaken, since 2003. I'm wondering if you can just start by giving us a sense of why this is such a crucial undertaking. Why Heinrich Schenker? Who is Heinrich Schenker?
Schenker was the most important theorist of the 20th century. And his work, though not terribly well known in his own lifetime, attracted the interest of pupils of his own pupils, primarily in the United States, and really took over as a major force in music education, especially at university levels.
I'd like to say that one of the principal reasons why I wanted Schenker Documents Online to come into existence was because we knew so little about Heinrich Schenker, the man and the mind, outside what we read in his, some years ago, rather inaccessible, but now much more accessible, thanks to translations, published work. But he is obviously a very interesting man. He's a man whose personality was suppressed by those who, from the 30s onwards, advocated his theories and, as it were, tried to present his theories as a scientific method rather than a cultural phenomenon. And I thought that we needed to say that that time is over. We no longer need to suppress this rather unpleasant personality. We need to find out about him and find out how he intellectually grew from the 1890s through till his death in 1935.
And so what is the extent of the Schenker documents? What does this archive consist of that you've been working with?
Well, it ranges from the mid-1890s to just before he died in January 1935, and it consists of a large quantity of correspondence, over 7,000 items, a very extensive diary, 4,500 pages of large paper, small writing, very, very detailed indeed, with all aspects of his activities. The notes that he made on lessons, all the lessons he gave between 1912 and the time of his death, and a huge quantity of other material which Schenker Documents Online on the whole doesn't cover. Analyses, notes on works, editions, and so on and so forth. Huge collections in the New York Public Library, in the University of California at Riverside, and in many, many different places dotted around Europe and the United States.
And how did this collection come to be so dispersed?
Well, if you write a letter to someone, that person receives it. And if you write a letter to hundreds of people receive it. So in theory, you could have a dispersal of the letters that you write all over the globe.
But Schenker was not based in the States. The majority of the collection was ended up
there. He was based in Vienna. Now, as far as the letters are concerned, we're lucky if the people to whom he wrote letters thought, this guy is worth saving. His correspondence is interesting. It may be valuable someday. So there are people who kept their letters from Schenker, and they have made their way into archives in various places. Most notably, Moritz Violin kept his letters and handed them to Oswald Jonas before he died. And Jonas was one of Schenker's major pupils in the late 20s, early 30s, and corresponded with him a lot. And one of the main people who brought Schenker's theories to America. And at his death, his papers, which included Violin's, were taken up by the University of California at Riverside. So there, we have a large amount of material. And Jonas also had Schenker's diary, which was given to him by Schenker's widow, and that also went there. So we have a large number of letters. And one of the things is that Schenker kept all the letters, not all of them, but he kept quite a few of the letters that people wrote to him. So we have a kind of one-sided correspondence for many of the people with whom Schenker exchanged ideas, a bit like the Beethoven conversation books, where people wrote in a little booklet for Beethoven, who was deaf, what they wanted to say to him, and then he would reply back. And we don't have Beethoven's messages. We don't have a lot of Schenker's messages. However, Schenker summarized, often quite briefly, but sometimes in detail, he summarized what he'd written to other people in his diary entries.
There's another thing which we should bring up here, though. You just touched on it a moment ago. Schenker died in 1935. His widow was deported to the Theresienstadt camp in 1942, and she knew this was going to happen because they'd attempted to take her three times and somebody had managed to save her. And during those last years, between 40 and 42, she gathered up all of the materials that Schenker had left, because he was an inveterate hoarder of everything. Thousands and thousands and thousands of loose sheets of paper. She organized them, made a catalogue of them, put them into trunks and gave them to responsible people and commissioned them to take them to the United States. That's why the central core of his material is on the two shores of the United States.
That's fascinating, and what a journey. Thank goodness that she put all of that effort into actually preserving that material in the first place and getting it out of the country. And Ian, you talked earlier on about Schenker's pupils wanting to sort of suppress the man as a somewhat unpleasant personality. So at what point did it become possible to kind of break away from that and make these documents available? Is that something that's only quite recent?
Yes, it is. It's really only since the 1970s. The first collection of his papers that became available to the public was the one in Riverside, California, which has the diaries and a huge amount of letters as well as other materials. So those have been available since then. Then the materials that went to New York Public were finally edited in the late 1980s and became available in 1989. So much of it is very recent.
And what was the impetus for putting together the digital project that has become Schenker Documents Online? What was the driving force behind that?
Well, there's a little story related to that, so let me tell you that. Bill was editing a translation of Schenker's periodical Der Tonwille, very, very important work which had been only available in German and difficult to get hold of into the bargain up until he did that work. And around 2001, he and I started discussing what we would do in the general preface, because we were going to write the preface jointly, actually two prefaces, one to each of the two volumes. He took on discussing the content and the development of the content and thought. I took on the history, the genesis of the Tonwille. And I knew that the publisher was Universal Edition in Vienna, and I knew that Universal Edition's letters to Schenker were available all in the New York Public Library. I was living and working in New York at the time, so I had access to those. But the big thing that was missing was all of Schenker's letters to Universal Edition. They seemed to have gone. And I went to see a friend of mine in Nottingham in July 2011, and he asked how the Schenker work was going, and I told him that we were missing this vast collection of letters. He sent off an email. This fellow, John Tyrrell, was very well connected in all sorts of places in Central Europe. He sent off an email to a friend of his, Heinz Stolber, who worked and still works in Universal Edition, mentioning this. And 2 days later, back came an email saying, do tell Ian Bent that all the letters from Schenker to Universal Edition do in fact survive. They're on indefinite loan from Universal Edition to the City Library and the Rathaus in Vienna. And there are 446 letters and they can be consulted. So I then wrote to the City Library and they agreed to make photocopies of all of these materials. Some of these letters go to as long as 12 or 16 pages. And magically, there was a wonderful moment in October 2002 when a brown paper parcel landed on my doorstep at my apartment in New York. And there was what I thought really I would never see. When we had that, and we had the two sides of the correspondence, I said, we've got to publicise this and we've got to make it permanent in some way. And by far the best way is to do it digitally. So I talked with my computer people in Colombia and they agreed to set up some software for me as a kind of prototype for a proper job to be done a few years onwards. And by 2004, they had created this custom-built version of a blog software called Movable Type. And the first letter went up, I think I have a note of it, on the 12th of June 2004. By 2006, we had about 500 letters and a vast number of diary entries. So that's the long answer to your question.
So this is an enormous collection of material. Clearly, from what you and Bill have said, there's an enormous amount of material here in terms of correspondence, in terms of what made it over to the States, the material that the Universal Edition had, correspondence elsewhere in Europe. So this has become an international project. This is very much a collaboration between UK, US, Austria and Germany, would it be fair to say?
Yes. Yes, that's quite true.
And what have been the benefits and the challenges, if you like, to working across international boundaries in this way, trying to pull that material together?
Well, I think it's been a wonderful experience because we were able to locate about a dozen people who had a very strong interest in Schenker and had very good language abilities, whether their native language is English or German, and to tempt them to take on batches of letters, maybe 180, maybe 150 or so, that we saw could possibly interest them. And so very quickly we had a substantial number of people generating material. And in fact, it was hard for me, who at that time was the only person doing encoding, it was hard for me to cope with the extent, the rapidity with which things came in. And I kept on being divided in my loyalties between the different people.
In terms of, perhaps you could also say, Bill, maybe say a little bit about the fact that this is a dual language resource, Schenker Documents Online.
Oh, yeah. You can, if you Google Schenker Documents Online, it'll come up in the usual way, and you will be able to click on different types of document, and you will see the ones that we put up on the system are in the German original and in English translation with a set of English footnotes, annotations explaining what's going on. There's a lot of material to translate. It has to be done at speed because of the amount of the sheer quantity. We don't want this project to have to go on for decades. We'd like it to come to an end. So,
well, I said it would take 15 years back in 2004 to complete. That was my estimate.
Oh, wow. That's not far off.
12 years into it now, and we've done nearly 2,000 of the 7,000 letters.
Yeah, but we've done nearly all of the diaries.
Yes, that's true. For the first 4 or 5 years, the project was essentially based in this country. We were driving it. That's why the footnotes are in English and so on and so forth. But around about 2008, we found somebody in Vienna who was interested to contribute an organizing role to the project, Martin Eibel. With him, there was somebody who was taking part in the panel this morning, Marco Deisinger, and a wonderful lady called Ibi, who is a magnificent encoder. Martin then applied for money from the Austrian government. That ran for 3 years. So they got, as it were, two headquarters, very closely in contact with each other, very well coordinated, but two centres.
And after the funding for that part of the project enabled scholars to put the diaries from 1918 to 1925 online in German, in the German original and in English translation, I then applied for funding from the AHRC on behalf of the entire team. Mm-hmm. We put together a proposal to the AHRC, and miracles of miracles, we got it. And so it became based notionally at Southampton University, where Kirsty Hewlett and Georg Burgstaller became our PhD students and contributed in their own ways to the project. So that went on for 3 years, extended by half a year because I was ill part of the time, and we got a continuation, a stay of execution, so to speak, from the AHRC. Meanwhile, the Austrians, led by Martin Eibel and with Marco Deisinger, applied again to the Austrian Science Fund and were given a further 3 years of funding to make up all of the missing links in the diary. So we will have, by the end of 2017, a complete run of diary entries from 1917 to the end of Schenker's life and from 1912 to 1914. So that leaves the war years and the very early years. And Andrea Reiter, also at the University of Southampton in the Department of Modern Languages, has been putting together a bid for further funding. And fingers crossed, we'll be able to cover the war years because she'll have a particular interest on what the diaries tell us about life in Austria during the period 1914 to 1918. And that will also, could also tie in with the centenary events, scholarly events, marking the First World War.
I want to come back to this question of funding and keeping a project like this afloat in terms of the cast of thousands that you need to make it work and so on in a moment. But first of all, Georg, could you maybe explain how you came to be involved in the project and what your role has been?
Well, I think once Bill and at the University of Southampton was looking for two PhD students, I think that was part of the bids that there would be that kind of remit, and one would be based in music and the other in modern languages with the aforementioned Andrea Reiter as a supervisor, maybe adding kind of a sociocultural research into Shanushenko the man beyond his work as a theorist. And because I think it was very beneficial to have someone who was a native German speaker for this, I did that.
And you're now working for Rilm.
Yes, that's right.
And so the kind of archival research that you were doing for Schenker Documents Online, did that inform your decision to go into working in an organisation that is primarily about...
I think so, yeah. It was certainly part of it. And I think we were lucky, that Kirsty and I, that during our time in Southampton, we really had all the sources to our disposal. We were encouraged to use the sources that became newly available on Schenker Documents Online, of course, but we also looked at the original German, archival material, which was available mostly on microfilm from the archives, as well as Schenker's publications.
And so what was the subject of your PhD?
My PhD looked into Schenker criticism in the broadest sense, including music criticism. So it looked at his views on music criticism, journalism, and at the same time, as a kind of a semantic play, it looked at his own criticisms, his cultural criticisms.
And so in terms of actually what all of this documentation can tell us, in addition to Schenker's analytical work, his teaching, we've got angles on criticism. What other kinds of topics does he tend to discuss in the correspondence, in the diaries? Are there clear common themes that come out?
I think he wrote about everything. You give me a topic, he will have written about it, and that's what makes it quite gratifying to actually work on Schenker, because here you will find anything, which there's also methodological trapping here, that sometimes, if you just look at a small cachet, you will think, oh, this makes all perfect sense. But it's really only such a small part of this huge archive of his documents that it kind of skews the view a bit. He certainly wrote about the culture of his day. He wrote about technology. He had a kind of an ultra-conservative disposition, or he sort of acquired it, I think, over the years. And so he was very critical of anything that sort of was a modern phenomenon, from democracy to technology, certainly modernism and art. And he came to sort of conflate that with his views on music, where he looked towards a backwards kind of utopia, with the true masterworks being sort of sealed in the past, really, with Brahms' death.
He had an opinion about everything, and he was informed about quite a few things. He was very well read. He probably would have made an excellent scholar of German literature if he hadn't had an enormous musical talent, which was recognized at a very early age. And in his diaries, he would observe people that he came into contact with and often wrote minutely about their behavior, especially when it offended him. He would remark on what they had done and why it had offended him. And then the next paragraph in the diary would be a general commentary about that aspect of behavior as concerns people in general. Now, at the end of his life, he didn't have the time to do that. But around 1911, 12, 13, this is the area I'm looking at now, the diary entries go on for, it's them single days, will go on for a couple of pages with this sort of commentary.
If I may just add, this was also the time when he, for whatever reason, maybe to do with the Beethoven monograph, with his work on the Beethoven sonatas, he turned against everyone. I believe there's not a single contemporary scholar, writer, whatever, that he actually was complimentary about. So he turned against music historians, certainly about music theorists, performance audiences, he was critical of pretty much all of the musical culture.
There was one musicologist whom he respected and seems to have respected throughout his life, and that is Otto Erich Deutsch. And I will be talking about him later this morning.
Well, can I butt in on the matter of observing people? Because there's a nice example of that in 1916. Schenker had a person who worked for him on and off, a very shadowy figure called Aaron Mittelmann. And he seemed to work for the editor of one or two journals. He did editing work, he did proof corrections and so on and so forth. And when Schenker was coming up towards finalising an edition or an analytical work, he would call Mittelmann in for hours at a time to go over his texts, check them, raise issues and so on. Mittelmann was obviously a classical scholar, a very intelligent man, but a very wayward one who obviously tended to get drunk and go completely off the rails. And there was an occasion in 1916 when he vanished, and a number of people searching around trying to find him, they found he was in prison. He'd been in prison because he got into a brawl in the street and he'd shouted some offensive words. I think the offensive words were black and gold flag, which had great significance at that time in 1916. And so the police had taken him in and he was taken up to the military court. Anyway, there came an occasion when Schenker was going to visit him in the prison, and you get this little section in the diary and it goes on for about 2 pages. So it's, well, it's 800 words, something like that. And only the last line is about Mittelmann, because all the rest is about his observation of the prisoners themselves and their demeanour and their manner and their voices and the people who visited them, how intimidated they are, and how wives would come with their children to see their fathers and so on and so forth. So you've got 2 pages of observation and one line about this poor man.
That's extraordinary, and it's obviously an amazingly rich resource in terms of the number of different subjects that it can inform about this collection. It's not just of interest to music historians or analysts or those interested in the history of pedagogy. There's obviously an awful lot more generally about Austrian cultural life during Schenker's lifetime that he's reporting, which makes it a wonderful thing for many, many different scholars to draw on, and having it in a digital format makes it that much more accessible. Have you found, since you started the project, that attitudes to having a large digital resource like this have changed in the UK? Because at the point that you set it up, it was presumably, given its scale, its international ambitions, quite an unusual and new approach to putting this much material together.
Well, there were quite a lot of projects by then in the literary field, particularly. I know there were projects editing the works of certain 18th century French writers, for example, Enlightenment writers, and there were others as well that we looked at the time that we determined how Schenker Documents Online itself in 2008 should begin to do. So in a way, we were entering into what was already a wave of large-scale projects with very sophisticated searching facilities and so on, rather than just putting up static images on the web, making them searchable, flexible in many different ways.
I recall many years ago external examining at the University of Lancaster, and one of the students told me, well, I'm not going to go to the library to find something out. I'll just check on my computer and see what information is there. And I was shocked by that. I mean, this was before the days you could just Google something and get that. Wikipedia didn't exist in those days either. Or if it did, I didn't know about it. And now all of us, when we need some information in a hurry, we just go to our computer and Google the words that we're interested in. And scholars are doing that with Schenker Documents Online. You know, young academics, they're going to write an article on Dvorak. They'll probably want to find out what Schenker had to say about Dvorak. And there aren't any analyses in the published writings of Schenker about Dvorak. So they'll Google Schenker Dvorak and come up on Schenker Documents Online with perhaps half a dozen statements or more about Schenker listening to Dvorak on the radio or hearing him in a concert hall or making notes about a particular piece of music, then that goes into a PhD thesis.
So it's become an authoritative source. The online archive has increasingly become an authoritative research source.
It's become a well-used source. Mm. And I don't think we have yet set up the mechanism for calculating the number of hits. That ought to come. Mm-hmm. I think we're doing rather well.
Get your Google Analytics account set up now. So let's just finish by talking a bit about funding and sustainability, because you've obviously had great success in the past with getting large pots of money in order to pull in a lot of different collaborators across different countries and different fields of expertise to make this project possible and to expand it and to try and get yourself through these many, many thousands of documents. What would you say are the key issues that Schenker Documents Online faces in terms of longer-term preservation and existence? Because certainly one of the things that is often raised when it comes to setting up digital projects is that getting the money to establish something is relatively straightforward if you have an interesting project. But actually, the sustainability of something like this is really where the difficulty can come.
Yes, it's a very important issue. When we first discussed with King's College London, the institution that created the Schenker Documents online site that now exists, apart from the one at Columbia, which I mentioned before, we knew that there was a thing called the Arts and Humanities Data Service, set up by the government, so that as digital projects were created, once they were established, they would be distributed to a number of other institutions and archival versions of created to make it absolutely rock solid. Between the time that we put in the application to the Leverhulme Trust at that time for the first large sum of money, and the time that we got it, the government in its wisdom had cancelled the AHDS. And there never has been a satisfactory solution to that problem since then. And that's what we're wrestling, and particularly Bill and Andrea are wrestling with at the present time. Because there are obviously logical things. First thing is King's College London. King's College London is a fine institution. It's done a wonderful job for us. I'd love it to stay there in perpetuity. But I know King's well enough because I worked there for 10 years back in the 60s and 70s. And I know that they can decide to drop something, you know, just on the flip of a coin. As can many other institutions as well. So I, like the rest of us, don't feel completely secure about it being there. Lots of obvious, lovely places that you think it could go to Vienna, it could go to Riverside, it could go to New York, to the New York Public Library. But actually persuading those institutions that it would be of interest for them to invest in this venture for many, many, many years and maintain it and keep it interactive is an extremely difficult thing.
Andrea Reiter has been putting a bid together for the continuation of the project to fill the gap of 1914 to 1917, 1918, around there. And included in that will, I think, be some additional funding that could be given to an institution to maintain the site for a number of years. I mean, I don't think that the word forever exists in the computing services world. And the question is, how many years is forever?
Mm. And would you say, I mean, for example, an organization like RILM that is there to catalogue and keep an eye on resources, presumably, I mean, primarily so far paper-based resources, do you think that there might be potential for an organization like RILM to take on the management of digital assets as well?
Possibly. I mean, we are doing just now, we're making MGG, Musik in Geschichte und Gegenwart, online, including quite a forefront of sort of setting all this up. I'm not really part of the technical aspect, although I do, and so involved a little with translations and things. So I think that there is also an idea that once MGG is running, it's a huge project, this could be done without bibliographies. So I think, by all means, I mean, I don't quite see how it, Schenker Documents Online is quite a different sort of beast, but there is certainly interest, and we all appreciate that the internet has become sort of primary, really, kind of a resource for research.
And that connection as well between archival models, cataloguing models that librarians and archivists are used to working with, plus the musicological work that you've been doing, plus the linguistic impact as well, and the technology. It's bringing all of those things together, isn't it? And then making that sustainable. Well, I hope very much that you managed to find somebody willing to give Schenker Documents Online a permanent home, because it's obviously a very rich resource with very much more to give. Thank you all very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.